Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with how much foreign policy has been an issue in this midterm election and speak with David Rothkopf, the CEO and publisher of Foreign Policy magazine and the author of the new book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. We will discuss how much exaggerated fears of Ebola and the Islamic State might have impacted Tuesday's election and look into why Americans are prone to overreact to foreign actors like Ayatollah Khomeini, Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, and the Islamic State who can sway elections, and why we take the bait from terrorists whose expressed aim is to terrorize us and spread fear. Then we'll go to Mexico City and speak with Dudley Althaus, a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal who covers Mexico and Central America, and joins us to discuss the capture of the fugitive mayor and his wife, who are accused of ordering the police in Iguala, the third largest city in Guerrero State, to fire on students, 43 of whom were then handed over to a drug gang and have been missing since late September. We will discuss how public anger in Mexico has exploded as a result of this latest of many drug-related atrocities, undermining President Peña Nieto's assurances that the country has turned the corner in the decades-long war on drugs that has cost over 150,000 Mexican lives. Then finally, we will go to Madison, Wisconsin, for what may be the only good news for progressives coming out of this midterms, that the Republicans are expected to sweep, and get an update from a state whose aggressively conservative Governor Scott Walker has bitterly divided the electorate. Lisa Graves, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and a former deputy assistant U.S. Attorney General and chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, joins us to discuss the unexpectedly high turnout in this key governor's race and whether Obama will be able to get any judicial nominations through a Republican-controlled Senate. And as of now, the results are such that Mitch McConnell has retained his seat in Kentucky, and the Republicans have picked up one Senate seat in West Virginia, and later in the program we should have more results. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor of the FP Group, publisher of Foreign Policy magazine, foreignpolicy.com, and presenter of FP Events. He is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead, Superclass, the Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making, and Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. His latest book just out is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
And David, what's your sense of how much foreign policy is playing in this election, which will perhaps not even be decided until sometime in January of 2015, given the anomalies of the states of Georgia and Louisiana requiring 50% vote, otherwise they go to a post-election runoff. But I've not noticed a great deal of foreign policy being hashed out here. Perhaps it's a subtext.
Well, you know, I think there are several ways to answer the question. One is, you know, what do the polls say? And there are a number of polls that suggest that foreign policy is not at the forefront of people's minds, that perhaps one in five people rate it as a priority, one in four people rate it as a priority. That's fairly typical for elections. But, you know, there are other ways to measure this. There have been, by metrics that I've seen, 1,000, 2,000 ads that have mentioned ISIS or mentioned Ebola as ways of going after the president and his competence. And I think as far as that last point goes, that's really the secret. People are viewing this to some degree as a referendum on Barack Obama. And Barack Obama's performance, the perceptions of Barack Obama as a leader, are very much colored by what he has done overseas. And so even if it doesn't show up in a polling question, I think it's clear that foreign policy is playing a very significant role in the way the American people view their president.
But the notion that Ebola and Islamic State are going to cross the border from Mexico, and either take over the country or infect the country is pretty preposterous. So it sort of gets to the subtitle of your new book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Isn't that what terrorists try to engender? Aren't they about spreading fear? Isn't that what it's all about? And why do we take the bait?
Well, those are two questions. You know, clearly, terrorism is about creating terror. And, you know, we did take the bait, and, you know, partially because 9/11 was a horrifying event, and the American people had felt pretty secure with an ocean on either side of them for a long, long time, and they didn't really have the kind of sense of vulnerability that people in other countries do. And then one day, while everybody was watching in real time, they saw a catastrophe, they saw the loss of human life, and they didn't just think of the threat, they felt it viscerally. And I think that ushered in this period of what I call an age of fear, the age of heightened vulnerability, that has had us looking at almost everybody in the world as a potential threat. You know, if a few people could take over a bunch of planes and destroy 17 acres of lower Manhattan, the reasoning would go, what if one person had a nuclear device or a bio device? And if you follow that reasoning any further, you end up with the idea that everybody everywhere is a threat, and you become pretty skittish, and we've been pretty skittish. And then, of course, there are politicians who either capitalize on that to advance their pre-existing agendas, see Iraq, or there are politicians who capitalize on it simply because they can use it to gain political advantage, scaremongering around Ebola or scaremongering around ISIS. Ebola and ISIS are serious problems. They're problems that have to be managed outside the United States, but they should not be, you know, sources of significant fear within the United States in the way that they have been.
So can you make the case, though, in terms of fear and paranoia, whether or not it's in our DNA, political DNA is, I suppose, a broader question, but just to touch on the Cold War, there was always this exaggerated fear of communism, and the McCarthy period, of course, was in many ways was a response to the Russians getting the atomic bomb. And, you know, I'm wondering, had we been, rather than be afraid of communism, why didn't they teach Marxism in school? It wouldn't have been such a surprise that the whole system collapsed when, you know, if you were educated to the point where you recognize that the USSR was a political system pretending to be an economy. And I spoke yesterday with the former senior British intelligence officer who's a specialist on Iraq and speaks Arabic. And we were talking about the 60 Minutes piece about these radical clerics in London recruiting young Islamists, 5 a week apparently leave England, 4 to join the Islamic State. And they have a very sort of tolerant view. But the conclusion we came to was that we don't know what drives these people. We never look into the nature of the system or the enemy or whatever it is, the culture, the history. We just react. And wouldn't it be useful? I mean, first of all, I'm absolutely dumbfounded as to what motivates these young people to join ISIS, and I'd really like to know.
Well, I mean, I think the understanding the threats that we face better is help us put them in some perspective. I happen to go to a college where the entire economics faculty was Marxist, and so it was pretty clear after a few economics courses what was going to happen on that front. But you know, there's an important story in this. You know, in the wake of World War II, we recognized the Soviet Union was going to be a threat, and in the United States, with McCarthyism and the kind of Red Scare, there was a desire to put us on a footing that would have almost inevitably led to war and conflict, driven by that fear. And Dwight Eisenhower, who had led the United States through World War II, said to his close advisors that, you know, he felt that wasn't the right approach. And he actually undertook a process through the White House called the Solarium process, where he brought groups of different people from different factions together and had them game out different alternatives. And he did this because he felt by allowing them to game these things out, that they would see that the best way to deal with the Soviet Union was to allow entropy to take place, to contain it, but give it time, because ultimately, if we let our system thrive, theirs would gradually become run down and collapse under its own weight. And it was his wisdom in bringing these people together, showing them what the future would be like, stepping away from the fear within his own party, led by his own party, that put us on a track where 30 years later, you had the end of the Cold War, without a shot being fired effectively. And that, you know, I think speaks exactly the point you're making.
Well, I remember years ago having a conversation with Paul Nitzer about the level of paranoia about the Russians or the Soviets moving into Africa and all this stuff. And he said that there actually was a paper or a program put forth that didn't get any traction called Geopolitical Indigestion. And that was the idea that if the Soviets took over more and more of the Third World, they would simply collapse quicker. But he said that our system just is not subtle enough to take that. And would that mean, therefore, that the military-industrial complex and other interests need the threat, whether or not it's real or not?
Well, I think there's certainly some people in the United States that benefit from the threat. You know, we have never turned the war machine off after World War II. We always come up with a new reason to keep producing weapons. And, you know, we continue to have a defense budget that is, you know, the total of the next 12, 13, 14 defense budgets added up in the world, particularly preposterous total when you consider that almost all those countries are our allies. So, you know, yeah, there's some economic interest in this whole thing that has fed the fear. There's a political interest. You know, people want to go after Obama. Look at the election. They'll say, well, you know, it was, you know, I mean, you had this, you know, idiot aide to Ted Cruz sending out some so-called joke saying, you know, well, before Obamacare, was there Ebola? You know, well, you know, that, I mean, it's a stupid joke, but, you know, it shows where his mind is. It shows the kind of the let's find anything to stir up the American people if we think we can get some kind of political advantage out of it. And then on top of that, you know, some of these things actually have a scary component. And the only way for tackling them puts, you know, some Americans at risk in some way. The ISIS is an example of that, where, you know, we do have to respond to it. The thought of establishing an extremist Islamic State in the middle of the modern Middle East could be extremely destabilizing, especially with these flows of foreign fighters that you mentioned. And so there is a kernel of a real threat in the middle of these things that needs to be responded to rationally rather than through fear. And I think the lesson of the past 15 years is that we have veered from one extreme to another, driven initially by fear engendered by terrorists, and then driven both by that and our kind of general fear that we would make more mistakes like we made during the Bush administration. And that at some point, we got to get our bearings back and start responding to these things in a rational, measured, balanced way.
Well, that's really, in many ways, what your book is trying to do, surely, David Rothkopf, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, covering both the Bush experience and the Obama experience, where we have sort of zigzagged dramatically from one aggressive interventionist policy to another one where you're trying to undo much of what was done in the first decade. So that leaves me, though, with the question about clearly presidents have enormous amounts of power, and whether or not Dick Cheney was a force greater than George Bush or whatever, but they both got us into that war, and in many ways it seemed to be the decision of a very few people, and they certainly weren't listening to people like Brent Scowcroft. And for reasons which still mystify me to this day, President Bush Sr. somehow did not offer his wisdom on the folly of invading Iraq, which would only benefit Iran. But that aside, it leads me to this question about our kind of, what would you call it, the national security bureaucracy, the permanent government, like they have in Britain. Isn't there a notion that you're supposed to have a cadre of smart people that have history, have continuity, and can advise presidents, as opposed to allow us to be whipsawed by the personal whims of whoever occupies the White House?
Well, when the system works properly, that's precisely what you're supposed to have. Gradually, what's happened over time is that the permanent parts of the government, civil servants and military, career intelligence officers, have been pushed farther and farther away from the decision process, with more and more layers of political appointees between them and the decision process. But even, you know, in that situation, if you use the political appointees properly, you use the National Security Council in the way that, say, Brent Scowcroft, who you mentioned, would have used it, where he was an honest broker, he brought together the best thinking, he created choices for President Bush. President Bush, George H.W. Bush, evaluated the choices, made a decision, and then this apparatus ensured that departments would follow through on it. It was an apparatus by which the permanent government as well as the political leadership were empowered and took advantage of the whole of the resources of the U.S. government. More recently, what we've seen is a small clique of people in the White House with a lot of influence over the president, alienated sometimes even from their own cabinet, not taking advantage of the full range of thoughts within the U.S. government, whether this was in the Bush first term when there were people in the State Department, for example, warning against the costs and downside of going into Iraq, or whether it is in this most recent administration where you've now had Panetta and Gates and Hillary Clinton and Valley Nasser and other people writing books talking about how alternative views were ultimately cut out in the first term, and now in the second term of the Obama administration, the diversity of views is substantially less than it was in the first term, which gives more influence to that small clique around the president, and doesn't take advantage of the real resources of the government or the range of views that that exist within it.
So is there also this other factor you'd mentioned in the number of political appointees that have more influence than the professionals, if that's, you know, the best term I can come up with? Does it also mean that leaders are often make decisions? They may get the best advice in the world, but at the end of the day, they make political decisions. I mean, do we have any?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, we have some examples of political leaders who've made decisions against the advice of the political teams around them. It's not popular to say so. George W. Bush did, you know, awesome damage to the United States in the first term of his administration. But, when he faced a second crisis, which was the financial crisis, by all reports, people in the administration, both career people and political people, Democrats and Republicans, you know, give him a lot of credit for how that was managed. And one of the central decisions there came when Hank Paulson went to the president and said, look, we need $1 trillion in order to stop the bleeding right now. And, President Bush said, this is going to be very politically damaging for me, but I agree that that's what we need, and so we're going to go and get it. That was an example of president going against public opinion and taking a tough decision that ultimately worked out in the best interest of the American people.
But that, of course, he was a lame duck almost at the end of his second term. Would that therefore apply to Obama, assuming that he becomes a lame duck with a hostile House and Senate? Would he have more room to maneuver in terms of, well, not more room to maneuver, but would he have more freedom to do what he thinks is right as opposed to what he thinks is politically wise?
Well, he's not running for anything.
Right.
I think that if you look at the last three two-term presidencies, which is to say George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ronald Reagan, all of them got more assertive and better at foreign policy in their last couple of years. Bush changed his team over completely, changed his strategy in the Middle East, changed his strategy in the developing world, had a number of big wins despite being off to a very rocky start. Clinton had the Kosovo campaign. He had the trade deal with China. He had a trade deal with Jordan. He began a Middle East peace process that very nearly bore fruit. Reagan, you know, his foreign policy apparatus ran aground on Iran-Contra. But in the last couple of years following the Tower Commission report, you had Frank Carlucci and Colin Powell running a national security apparatus in a way that was fairly sound and actually set the stage for what Bush and what Scowcroft did. So the last couple of years are really an opportunity for a president to take 6 years of experience and to grow and to be a more effective foreign policy president. What worries me right now about Barack Obama is he's not expanding the circle around him. He's not showing that he realizes that change would be desirable. He's quite defensive about the criticisms that are happening. And, you know, he could fritter away the last 2 years being defensive and not take advantage of the moment and essentially punt everything to the next president, whether that's Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney or whomever it is. And you know, that's the question we face in the wake of this election, is this president going to use foreign policy, which doesn't require as much of the United States Congress as do a lot of domestic decisions, to actually, you know, make big strides forward, or is he going to essentially do more of the same, in which case we're likely to have rather frustrating couple of years.
Well, just in closing, perhaps a question more for a psychiatrist than a political analyst, but what can be done to make us less susceptible to fear, make us less prone to be whipsawed by peculiar events in the Middle East? You know, we, after all, an obscure Palestinian, Sirhan, determined in many ways that Richard Nixon would be the president. The Ayatollah Khomeini pretty much finished Carter's career and ensured Reagan's election, and so on. I could go through a whole list, which leads you to conclude that maybe we don't control our political destiny. And that seems to be insane for a superpower.
Sane or otherwise, we don't control our destiny fully. Other actors can take steps. Putin could invade the Baltics and put Europe on edge. The United States initiative with ISIS could fail, and a new state could be formed there. Iran could detonate a bomb tomorrow. North Korea could invade South Korea. There are all sorts of things that could happen that, you know, the president of the United States will be forced to react to. But having said that, you know, there are different ways to respond, and I think, you know, we may well be able to look back on the past 15 years and say we've seen the swing from one extreme to another. We've seen what happens with fear. We have also come to recognize the cost that fear itself has, and that the force multiplier for terrorists lies within us and not within anything that they do, and that we can then choose to eliminate that force multiplier by becoming more rational, by turning down the, you know, frenetic food fight of political debate, by insisting that the political system around the president actually be as as it has been traditionally in terms of foreign policy, beyond partisanship, and create, you know, real choices for the president, and that he seeks a range of point of views. And we can learn from this. And frankly, that's what happens in history. And, you know, we fight wars. We then decide we're never going to fight a war again. We then see the costs of pulling back too much, and we find a more constructive middle ground. It's happened throughout American history, and I'm optimistic that we're at a point right now where it's about to happen again.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Rothkopf.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's the CEO and editor of the FP Group, publisher of Foreign Policy Magazine, foreignpolicy.com, and presenter of FP Events. He is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government, and The Reckoning That Lies Ahead, Superclass, The Global Power Elite in the World They Are Making, and Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. His latest book just out is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Mexico City, where a mayor and his wife on the run who were involved with the disappearance of 43 students have been captured.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. study war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside, down by.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dudley Althaus, who is a correspondent with The Wall Street Journal, who covers Mexico and Central America. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dudley Althaus.
Hello.
And the capture of the mayor of the city of Iguala, which I believe is the third biggest city in Guerrero State, José Luis Abarca, and his wife, Maria de Los Angeles Pineta Villa, they're accused of participating in the disappearance of the 43 students who disappeared over a month ago. This, I take it, is a significant break, right? They expect they may be able to shake these people down and find out what happened to these kids?
Well, yes, I think officials are hoping so. But, I mean, there's other people that think that maybe it's not going to move the ball forward that much, because these guys have basically been missing for more than a month, and they kind of left their town soon after the students disappeared. The Mexican government has 57 or 58 other people under arrest in relation to the missing students, and still haven't been able to find the students, whether alive or dead. So it's still unclear how much information the mayor and his wife can really give to the officials, but we'll see.
And this has gripped the country, has it not, the disappearance of these students? And it has called into question and certainly undermined President Peña Nieto's assurances that the country was actually turning around and that the drug wars, the darkest days of the drug wars were over.
Well, yeah, that's, I think, certainly the background story here. I mean, people have been pretty much assured that the worst of the drug violence, the criminal violence, was behind Mexico, and that people were, attention was turning to economic progress, economic development, new car plants, the energy industry being open to private investment, and other good news. It's not that the government's totally ignored the drug war. It certainly hasn't. They've arrested a number of top gangsters here, including Joaquin El Chapo Guzman and the head of the Juarez cartel. You'll remember that the war between those two in 2008 through about 2011-12 made Ciudad Juarez the most dangerous city in the world for a time. So, I mean, they've had some victories, but they've also just kind of been letting these other dogs lie, if you will. And the disappearance of these students has kind of just rattled everybody.
Well, it does seem, though, that this mayor and his wife, obviously they're not proven guilty at this point, but the Mexico's attorney general last month, you know, basically said that they had come to the conclusion, investigators had come to the conclusion that the Guerreros Unidos gang, who the police handed these 43 students over to, were in fact paying the mayor and his wife more than $150,000 every few weeks. And the chief of police of the town, of course, is still missing. So the collusion, I think that's what's really shocked people, isn't it? That, you know, it's not exactly a secret that Mexican police are a little scary, but the idea that you can't trust anybody and citizens have no basic human rights there is...
Well, I think that is the most important thing going on here. I mean, this is the shocking thing about Iguala is that it's not that shocking. It's there's a lot of cities and towns in Mexico that... are definitely under siege and often in cahoots with the local gangsters. The Guerreros Unidos gang is a breakaway group from the old Beltran Leyva cartel, and it's pretty much a regional gang. It's not even that big. This is not one of the major cartels, which is also kind of scary, because then you're looking at how many gangsters it takes to control a city of 150,000 people. And I mean, I think that's what's got everybody really kind of, you know, back on their heels.
So specifically what happened here was the mayor's wife was giving a speech in the town square, apparently outlining the virtues of their administration. And by the way, one of the shocking things is that the mayor, his wife, the governor of Guerrero, who stepped down, they're all members of the PRD party, which is supposed to be a progressive leftist party, isn't it?
Well, that's right, Ian, and that's one of the things that's changed here in the past 14 years at least party democracy in Mexico. I mean, all the political parties, a lot of politicians at the local level have changed shirts, if you will, with whoever's in the power at the moment. The Guerrero state government's been under control of the PRD for quite a while. I can't remember exactly, 12 or 15 years. And so local politicians, local guys with some power, like Abarca, I don't think they're joining these parties out of ideology. They're joining these parties out of sort of a political machine that they can join up with. And that's happening not just with PRD. It's happened with the ruling party, Peña Nieto's party, with the National Action Party, which ruled Mexico, of course, from 2000 to 2012. There's been a lot of politicians changing parties according to how the wind's blowing. So it's not really an ideological situation. But again, and then, you know, I mean, the issue is just how much control these gangsters have over these towns and cities. And I guess we're finding that out. And it's hard to really say how widespread this is. But I mean, the estimates go from anywhere where 2/3 of Mexico's 2,400 municipalities to, you know, a handful. I think the best guess is probably hundreds in the bad trafficking zones or drug-producing zones of the country.
And we're talking about the capture on Tuesday in a very poor neighborhood of Mexico City of the mayor of Iguala, Mexico, in the state of Guerrero, along with his wife, who have disappeared since the disappearance of the 43 students. I was saying earlier, just to give a recap for the audience what happened, that the mayor's wife, who apparently is, if she's not, she's certainly on the payroll of this drug gang, but her brothers are in the drug gang, and many have suggested that she actually runs the gang. I don't know whether that's true, but she was giving a speech. The students of a nearby rural teachers' college, who very, very sort of Marxist college, these young students are dedicated to educating the rural poor in Guerrero. They see some buses. They were going to, drive to Mexico City and join a protest, but the mayor apparently sicked the police onto them. They fired indiscriminately, the police, at the buses. They killed three students and three other innocent passerbys, and then they bundled the students, 43 of them, into police cars and then supposedly handed them over to this drug gang. Whether or not they told the drug gang that these kids were members of another gang, which is one of the reports I read, or they just basically said, get rid of them. But is that pretty much what happened?
Well, that's almost exactly what happened. As far as what the government says happened, we're still not clear on all this, but yeah, definitely that's pretty much the timeline. You know, I think what I and my colleagues here at the Wall Street Journal think is that the best guess is that things got out of hand. The police ordered to stop the students from coming into the city, and then I don't think you can't see anybody who wins from disappearing 43 students. You know, the governor's already been forced from office. Now the mayor, who was on the run for 6 weeks, been arrested. Peña Nieto's image or narrative certainly has taken a hit. So I mean, it's hard to see who wins. So yeah. That's pretty much what happened. And there's a lot of mysteries. And, you know, it's the investigation's been moving very slowly. It's gone back and forth in different issues. And, you know, we're just not sure how this is going to play out. Again, you mentioned this. I mean, the mayor and his wife have not declared whether they're innocent or guilty of anything. And we're not really quite sure of all the charges they face. But they have been missing since being requested by state prosecutors in Guerrero State, which includes Acapulco, of course, and Zihuatanejo, which a lot of Americans visit. They were required to come in and talk about the incident by state prosecutors, and they've been missing since. They went on the lam, if you will.
So the expectation, at least the hope, particularly on the part of the parents of these 43 missing school kids is, or young, I guess they're in their late teens, early 20s, is the possibility that somebody will, the case will break open and they'll be able to find out where these bodies are. Why is it that they keep searching for bodies, they find bodies and they say that they're not the same bodies? But I mean, is it so bad that there are just, you know, burial sites all over the place in Mexico? I mean, that's
Yes, it is that bad. Not all over Mexico, but in many of the drug producing and trafficking sections of Mexico, which is quite a large area, especially in the southwest of Mexico, Guerrero, Michoacan, neighboring Michoacan, parts of Mexico State. It is that bad, and up along the U.S. border. You know, there are 22,000 people missing in 8 years of this criminal violence, this drug war that Mexico has been living through. 22,000. Now, some of those, not all those people were murdered, not all those people. You know, some people don't want to be found. They just left bad situations. Who knows? But, I mean, you can assume a lot of them are murdered. And a lot of them haven't been found. This is shocking because of the sheer number and because these students, even though they're rabble-rousers, they're from a pretty politicized, radically politicized teacher's college, a leftist teacher's college, and have known for shutting down highways and holding protests and all that sort of thing. There's no conclusive proof that we've seen, although there's been whispers that they're somehow involved with drug trafficking or drug production. We haven't seen anything that would be conclusive on that. So these are basically innocent, you know, students who were disappeared at the hands of police, and that's pretty scary.
So what is the role of the U.S. in this, do you think? I mean, we have this odd situation here in the United States where most of the drugs are sold, where the money that these drugs generate is made for these cartels, shipped back there across the border, and yet we sort of don't feel any obligation. And by the way, we're also where a lot of the arms that these cartels use, you know, heavy weaponry, assault rifles, etc., come from. So I'm curious as to why this hasn't really broken so big here in the United States, this story. I believe it's very, very prominent in Mexico, but it's sort of not really resonating here in the United States, and yet we are, you know, inextricably bound in the war on drugs as the market for the drugs, and we're the ones that pay the money, where the money comes from to fund these drug gangs.
And have been. I mean, I think the U.S. public and U.S. Narcotics consumers definitely should think about this. You know, this has been going on for quite a few years. And yes, these gangs still make most of their money from trafficking narcotics to U.S. consumers. Having said that, in Guerrero, in particular, in this part of Guerrero, the major business is producing marijuana and opium poppies. Of course, the heroin epidemic in the States is being fed by the opium poppies from Guerrero and other Mexican states in a large part. So, yeah, there's a definite connection. Having said that, the Guerreros Unidos band also makes a lot of money from extortion of local businesses and where they operate, of kidnappings, a lot of different crime. And that's pretty much happening all over Mexico. These gangs are moving into other vice rackets that have nothing to do with the international drug trade. But certainly the initial growth of the gangs in Mexico, that what created this monster, was definitely fueled by U.S. narcotics consumption. I think you make real good points.
Well, just in closing, what's your sense, Dudley Althaus, of what the new President Enrique Peña Nieto, is going to do, given that this has given him a black eye following his assurances that the country had turned a corner in the war on drugs and the worst was over, and now the worst is happening and it's still happening and these students' bodies still haven't been found. And
What's interesting, Peña Nieto yesterday on Monday called for a pact between all the major political parties here, very much like the pacts they made to push through 11 different economic and social reforms here in the past 2 years. So he's called for a pact between all the parties that should be signed by this week or should be agreed to by this week because he's traveling to Asia at the weekend, I believe. He's called for a pact to assure that Iguala won't happen elsewhere again. Now, we don't really know how that plays out or what the details of that might be or, you know, what that might mean, whether it's just window dressing. But I think certainly the people in the administration are as shaken up by this as anybody would think. This has been a wake-up call for them. And so we'll see how they respond to it. So far, they've not been responding to it in any specific way besides putting the federal government investigators onto the case. And Peña Nieto making repeated speeches in the past 5 weeks about the need to establish rule of law in Mexico. And his predecessor said that, and the predecessor of his predecessor said that. And presidents of Mexico have said that ever since I've covered this place. So we'll see what happens.
But the famous expression, or the infamous expression, plomo y plata, silver or lead, that is the deal that you are offered, particularly if you're a policeman or to join a gang. In other words, you take the silver or you take a bullet. And given how much money these gangs generate, it's not surprising that underpaid policemen decide to take the money and not the bullet. So how do you break that cycle?
Well, I think instead of silver or lead, I think it's silver and lead.
Silver and
lead. I think that cops get pulled into this. I mean, local police officers make about $100 a week at the most. And so they make it up through other ways. That leaves them very open to extortion, obviously, or to corruption, or to extorting local businesses as well, or to being corrupted by drug gangs. That said, once you're inside, even if you're an honest cop, you know, you're always in the crosshairs. But if you're a cop, you know, you shouldn't think about these cops making a whole lot of money from the drug gangs. They're making, you know, maybe their payoff $50 a week, $50 or $100 a month. I mean, it's not much money. But once you're in, you're in. And people don't really suffer any kind of betrayals, real or imagined. So, no, they're definitely in a really tight spot. Journalists, Mexican journalists in the provinces are in the same situation a lot of times. They're under tremendous pressure at the local level to not print things or to print things specifically demanded by the local gangsters. And you get caught in the cross currents, if you will, of these changing gangs and everything. This part of Guerrero, where Iguala is, has been a battleground between the Guerreros Unidos and another group, Los Rojos. And so it's really the dangerous situation when you're in a situation where there's a real rivalry for a local market or for a local area of the country. Otherwise, it's pretty much peaceful. And everybody's living under the thumb of some people, but you don't really see any mass kind of killings or that sort of thing. So I don't, what's the solution? I don't know what the solution is exactly, but I mean, I think that you have to be much more conscious of what's going on at the local level in Mexico, not the higher levels of just the drug lords, the famous names, if you will.
Well, Dudley Althaus, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Dudley Althaus, who's in Mexico City, where he's a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, covering Mexico and Central America. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll go to Madison, Wisconsin, for an update on the key governor's race, where Governor Scott Walker is facing a stiff challenge.
Yeah. Wisconsin has its pleasures. Take muskies in July. Winter's nice with all that ice and snow at Christmas time. Beer and brats are tasty, but quite apart from these, there is only one thing that we love, and that is cheese. Hey, I'm a living cheesehead that you are talking to, and cheeseheads stick together like, darling, I'm with you. So if you really love me, and when you end up, please, honey, I come from Wisconsin. Give me sex or give me cheese.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of ALEC-Exposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having us on.
And so far in this critical midterm election, we've learned that Mitch McConnell has held on to his seat in Kentucky. The Democratic challenger was absolutely behaved ridiculously by not admitting that she had voted for Obama and was being, weaseling her way around that particularly. Not being able to put that question to rest. And we know at this point that the Tea Party, Tom Cotton, has picked up the Senate seat in Arkansas, and in West Virginia, the Republicans have picked up a seat. So they have two pickups so far. Is there anything that I've been talking about Mexico and foreign policy? So is there anything that's on your radar that I've missed here?
Well, we've been certainly watching what's happening here in Wisconsin and across the country. I think the polls just closed here in Wisconsin, and so we don't know yet what's going to happen in the governor's race here in the Badger State, where Scott Walker, who's an extremely controversial governor, has been facing a challenge by Mary Burke, who's a former executive with a major, international bicycling firm, a bicycle manufacturer. And it's been close. The polls have been going back and forth and back and forth all month, and so we won't know for a couple hours what happens here in the state. The turnout seems to be high. In fact, here, I think in a number of other states, they're looking at record turnout in this midterm election. And so we'll see. The Senate certainly faces a year this year in terms of the vacancies and where those vacancies are. Only a portion of the Senate is up for election every 2 years. And in this year, the predictions certainly have been favoring Republicans, but I don't know that we know that yet, but obviously we know that there are those two pickups you mentioned, and that McConnell has held his seat.
Well, Lisa, I wanted to talk to you, one, because you're in Wisconsin, and I figured that if Scott Walker is bumped off by the challenger, Mary Burke, that would be one of the few pieces of good news for progressives across the country. And two, because you had worked both for the Justice Department as Deputy Assistant Attorney General and as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, I also wanted to get some insight into what you think will happen, assuming that the Republicans pick up. They only need, I think, three more seats, and then probably four, I think, because of the Vice President's ability to do a tie. But in any case, they're getting close as we speak. How close is this, though? When you say there's been a record turnout in Wisconsin, that would indicate that might favor the Democrats.
Right. It looks as though, they're predicting that the turnout could reach 2.5 million people. I know that may not be a lot in California standards, but in Wisconsin, numerically, it's a lot, which means it's, more than 50% of the people who are eligible voting. Obviously, we all wish that more eligible voters voted. But in the precincts that we've heard reports from around here, there's been record turnout in some of the Democratic precincts. I know that the Republican base has been, really spurred on by a bunch of ads that the Koch brothers and their allies have been running in the state. We'll see what happens here. I do think that what happened in Wisconsin so far, does in some ways give insight into the importance of judicial nominations. Here in Wisconsin, a judge who was appointed to the bench by George Herbert Walker Bush back in the day is someone who basically tried to strike down a criminal investigation into Scott Walker's closest allies here, who've been coordinating, his main campaign guy, coordinating on election ads, according to the the evidence in the criminal case, that federal judge, you know, tried to destroy evidence. He ordered that the evidence of an ongoing criminal investigation be destroyed by trying to expand the Supreme Court's terrible Citizens United decision to basically nullify Wisconsin's campaign laws on coordination. And subsequent to that, he has basically written his own loophole into Wisconsin election law that's driven millions of more money, millions more dollars into the state, including out-of-state money from Sheldon Adelson. So, you know, this judge here has tried to, I think, have an undue influence on this election. And federal judges, certainly the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court in its decision in Citizens United has had an extraordinary impact on our elections. And in fact, this may be the election that John Roberts was hoping for when he helped bring Citizens United down.
Well, that I've actually heard before, Lisa, that people are calling it the John Roberts election.
Well,
or in fact, the Citizens United election. Sorry.
You know, he didn't write that decision. Obviously, he gave that decision to Kennedy. But in fact, he orchestrated that decision, and that's that judge, Justice Roberts, was handpicked by George W. Bush for the court. And you know, with the change of that court, with the addition of Samuel Alito joining Justice Scalia and Thomas Kennedy there, they have a 5-person majority. And one of the questions will be whether they extend that majority if there's another vacancy by a Democrat. Both of the Democrats are quite old. Both of the older Democrats who are Clinton nominees are older. And so if one of those vacancies comes up, I think this Senate, if it is a Republican-dominated Senate, is going to make it very hard to correct that Citizens United decision, or at least prevent that majority from growing bigger.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. So in terms of Scott Walker, there is, I mean, I think it's fairly significant nationally because he is a real rising star in the Republican Party, and conservative donors love him because he comes from a purple state, or even a blue state, Wisconsin, yet he was uncompromising and he was, you know, aggressively conservative and took on the unions, took away collective bargaining. He's created an extremely bitter and polarized political electorate there. But I take it this is what they like about him, is that he doesn't try to govern all of the people. He's very partisan. And that's the kind of candidate that a lot of the conservatives seem to want. So if he loses, that might be a blow to the dreams of some of the plutocratic backers.
Well, he certainly has received support from the Koch brothers and from some of the other really wealthy billionaires in the country. You know, he's someone who has been lauded by these Tea Party-like groups, by the Koch coterie of groups. That's Koch Industries, not Coca-Cola. And he's someone who apparently has aspirations for the White House himself. So if he were to be defeated this evening, that would certainly be a blow to those aspirations and to some of that vision. The thing about Walker, as someone who has lived here during his reign in office, you know, he didn't run on that platform back in, you know, back in 2010. He ran on this "I'm just a simple guy with my brown bag lunch" campaign. He didn't talk about crushing unions or taking $1 billion out of the public schools. But as soon as he got in office, he started to push the ALEC agenda, the agenda of the American Legislative Exchange Council, and other right-wing proposals of the Kochs, and really try to cram them down the throats of the people of Wisconsin. So, you know, he may win, he may not, but he has proven to be perhaps the most controversial governor in Wisconsin's history.
Well, and also the recall, of course, did not work, and I think in part because, you know, the Wisconsin voters are fairly, I think, fairly centrist, and you know, nice people. I was trying to think of a better way to put it, but I think well, that's true. They're nice people, and they thought that, you know, he hadn't been it hardly been in office, and it just wasn't right to get boot him out. But this time around, I guess it's a slightly different climate. I mean, I know Madison is sort of a liberal bubble in a state that in the countryside is quite red. But what's your sense then of when we'll know, because this could go down to the wire, right? It's pretty close.
Yeah, I think it could go to the wire. I mean, Wisconsin, I have to say, speaking as a Wisconsinite, Wisconsinites are very nice. But what we didn't know last time around was that one of the groups running these ads saying that the recall was not the Wisconsin way, even though recall proposals, that procedure was basically nearly invented in Wisconsin by the progressive movement, which was a Republican movement, the progressive Republicans at the turn of the century. And it turned out that those ads were being run by a group that was a shadowy out-of-state group that, again, is connected back to this sort of Koch network of donors. And so the group saying that wasn't the Wisconsin way weren't even Wisconsinites. So it's, you know, more dark money in this state having undue influence. It's happening in states across the country. In California, more than a year ago, there was a huge fine, a record-setting fine against one of these groups that was run by an operative of the Koch brothers. You know, I think that they're perhaps, you know, the most corrupting influence in our politics today, and they have their hands through their operatives in elections across the country trying to distort results, and they're empowered in part by the Citizens United decision by five guys in the court, on that Supreme Court, who are extremists and activist judges. And, you know, they're trying to basically remold our country in their image. I think it's a frightful image, but, you know, money has an impact, and they certainly are trying to influence these elections through their operatives in the states, in Florida, through the Americans for Prosperity groups, and Wisconsin and other states. And I think that, you know, we'll see whether the people can see through that or not.
Well, there's no question that the President Obama is going to, if the Senate goes the way it appears to be going, although now we're just learning that Louisiana is going to go into a runoff in December, so the whole thing may not be over till December, or even if Georgia is hanging in the balance, it won't be over till January. That gets to our dysfunctional election system that is a whole other matter. But Obama has not really been very aggressive in getting the judiciary rebalanced. It's so stacked, federal judiciary is so stacked to the right because of proponents of Republican presidents. And Clinton, I guess, managed to rebalance it a little bit, but he went after centrists because they have been very aggressive, the Republicans, in their litmus tests. And Obama seems to have gone after a centrist, but they blocked and blocked and blocked. If he gets a chance at a Supreme Court nomination, what's going to happen? Is he forced to put up a right winger?
Well, I'm concerned that what would happen is that he'd end up appointing some sort of former federal prosecutor, or some sort of big firm law firm partner who, you know, might not be as progressive, just because there'd be the concern that they wouldn't be able to get through the Senate. So the last time around, you know, Senator Hatch takes credit for getting Justice Breyer onto the court. His deal he cut at the time, he claims, was to get older Democratic nominees. So they were progressive, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and
Breyer,
but they were older.
Right, they wouldn't last long. Well, look, yeah. We ran out of time, Lisa, and I guess a whole bunch of results are going to be coming in at any minute here. But I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Attorney, Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.